Exodus 14 puts us right into the heart of the book and right into probably the most iconic section of Exodus, the parting of the Red Sea. And so Exodus chapter 14, they have, in the first part of the chapter, God sent them to wander a little bit. And so he'd have them go over to this area and then backtrack. And God specifically told Moses that by doing that, by having them move around the encampment in such a way that kind of seemed like they were lost or confused, it would embolden Pharaoh to say, you know what, we need to go back out there and get him. And so we've seen all the way through the book of Exodus that the plan was to use the hardened heart of Pharaoh to glorify God. So Egypt is at this time, it's the Egyptian Empire, the most powerful nation in all the civilized world. And we've seen 10 plagues that have brought them to their knees. But Pharaoh himself is still alive with his army. And so now they've come out to take on the Israelites. And they've drawn near. And the Israelites have cried out to Moses and saying, look, he's coming. We're going to die out here in the wilderness. He's brought his chariots, his horsemen, his soldiers. We're going to die out here. And then God is going to do a great and mighty thing, starting in verse 13. He's going to part the Red Sea. So it says, Moses said to the people, do not fear. Stand by and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you have seen today, you will never see them again forever. The Lord will fight for you while you keep silent. One of the things that I love about the story of Exodus is there's this recurring theme. God is taking a group of people who were enslaved and totally oppressed and showing them who he is. And one of the things that he wants them to see is that the worse it looks, the less they need to be worried. Because at this point in time, it couldn't look much worse. They've been wandering around out here in the wilderness, and now they're adjacent right up against the Red Sea, so they're trapped. And Pharaoh and his army are coming with these chariots, and they can see them in the distance. And so from that standpoint, it couldn't be any worse. This is a group of people who are enslaved. They're not trained fighters. They're not prepared to defend themselves. This is a group that's brought their women and their children and their livestock. And I mean, this is not a fighting formation by any means, shape, or form. And they're backed up against the corner. And Pharaoh, with his empire, has brought the best soldiers money can equip. And so they're terrified, and God's answer is, I'll fight for you while you keep silent. I made you a promise that I would protect you, and I'm going to follow through with that promise. And so many times, the thing that we have to understand is that when God tells us something, and he says, this is how it will work out, our job is to just trust that and move on. That's why the Psalms say, wait upon the Lord, be still and know that I am God. Because God makes us promises sometimes. You say, how on earth is that ever going to work out? I don't know, but I know that it will. And so here in Exodus chapter 14, Moses will show them exactly how it is that God's going to save him. And says, the Lord said to Moses, why are you crying out to me? Tell the sons of Israel to go forward. As for you, lift up your staff, stretch out your hand over the sea, divide it, and the sons of Israel shall go through the midst of the sea on dry land. And as for me, behold, I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, so they will go in after them, and I will be honored through Pharaoh and all his army, through his chariots and his horsemen, and the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I am honored through Pharaoh, through his chariots and his horsemen. He says that the Egyptians will know that he is God. And previously he said that the Israelites will know. And then when they eventually make it to Jericho 40 years later and they run into Rahab, what we find out is not only did the Egyptians find out he's God and the Israelites find out he's God, all the surrounding nations found out he's God too. So these events are a polarizing set of events. And to think about how hardened Pharaoh is, he's going to part that Red Sea. The Israelites are going to walk through. What would it take for you to go into that Red Sea too? If you're the guy who's going to try and kill the people whom their God just parted the Red Sea for them to walk through on dry land, I don't have that kind of guts. Because it talks about the sea being a wall to them on both sides. I mean, you imagine you look up and there's a wall of water on this side and a wall on that side. And the water has piled up in such a way that such a massive amount of people have been able to go through. We're not just talking about a little thin pathway. This water must be piled quite high because we're talking about millions of people going through with all of their livestock and everything. Pharaoh must have been pretty hard-hearted to go in. So verse 19 then tells us the angel of God who had been going before the camp of Israel moved and went behind them, and the pillar cloud moved from before them and stood behind them. Now this is an important little detail. It may not seem like an important detail, but I'll show you in a second why it is. The pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire has been going in front of the Israelites, right? So they've been following that wherever they go. But now, at this moment, when Pharaoh's coming with his army, that pillar of fire and cloud moves behind them. And then right at the very end, we're going to see that it'll end up moving back in front of them for them to follow it again as they come out of the Red Sea. So that becomes important because 1 Corinthians chapter 10 will talk about the Israelites and this event here in the Red Sea. Paul will say, I want you to know, brothers, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. Well, when you talk about the Israelites and it says they're baptized into Moses, we know that word. That's a New Testament word we should be pretty familiar with. It means to be immersed. Well, if I'm going to baptize you, you're going to get wet. But what do we know about the Israelites with the Red Sea? They didn't get wet, did they? I mean, that was kind of the whole point. They don't get wet, right? They walk through on dry land. But what we have is this visual representation. The waters on both sides, right? You have the Red Sea parted on, and walls on both sides. And the cloud, it moved to the back, right? But then it's going to move to the front. Well, how's it going to move to the front? Where's it going to go? Right over the top of that Red Sea, isn't it? So there's going to come a point, and I want you to just picture this in your mind's eye because it's an epic picture. They're going through the Red Sea with water. Who knows how many feet high on this side, how many feet on this side, and then above them, the angel has brought the pillar of cloud and it's covering them above. And he says that was the moment where they were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. Now, in what way were they baptized into Moses? Well, one, were they immersed in water in the cloud? In a weird way, right? They were. They were surrounded entirely by it. And then the other thing is, when we talk about being baptized into Christ, which is what we are, we're not baptized into Moses, we're to be baptized into Christ. When we're baptized into Christ, now you belong entirely to Him, correct? That's the idea. New life, old man dead, new man belongs to Christ. You're part of His body. Well, when the Israelites went through the Red Sea, they're baptized into Moses. On the other side of the Red Sea, once they come out of that water, can they ever go back to Egypt again? They're done. Egypt wouldn't even accept them at that point, would they? What's going to happen when they come out the other side? After they come out of the water, what happens next? That water's going to collapse, right? And who's in the water? Be Pharaoh and his army is going to be in there. That's the point where they look back and they go, there's no more Egypt for us. We couldn't have that life if we wanted. And 1 Corinthians 10 uses that to give us a visual image so that we can understand exactly what it is that God intends for you and I when we become Christians. You're baptized, you come out of that water, and what did Jesus say about putting your hand to the plow? You put your hand to the plow, and what's the one thing you can't do when you do that? No looking back. That's right. There's no going back. Straight ahead. That's what baptism is. It's the beginning of a new life. Don't go back. You were never intended to. And if you do go back, and you do try and go back, you're just like the Israelites who said things like, oh, I wish we could be in Egypt where there's garlic and leeks. Oh, I miss that life back there. You're a grumbler, a complainer, and then you got some problems, right? We know how that works out for them. So in Exodus chapter 14, after they're going to go through here on dry land, it says, let's look at verse 21 and 22 here first. Moses stretched out his hand over the sea. The Lord swept the sea back by a strong east wind all night, turned the sea into dry land, so the waters were divided. And the sons of Israel went through the midst of the sea on the dry land, and the waters were like a wall to them on the right hand and on their left. And the Egyptians took up pursuit. And verse 25 will point out that as they're pursuing, their chariot wheels were caused to swerve, and he made them drive with difficulty. So the Egyptians said, let us flee from Israel, for the Lord is fighting for them against the Egyptians. Then you get down to about verse 28. It says, waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen, even Pharaoh's entire army that had gone into the sea after them. Not even one of them remained. But the sons of Israel walked on dry land through the midst of the sea, and the waters were like a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. And the Lord saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians. And Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. And when Israel saw the great power which the Lord had used against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and in his servant Moses. What happened in the Red Sea? They're baptized into Moses. And they come through on the other side. They see the Egyptians dead on the seashore. And now they believe in God. And we're told early in the chapter that the Egyptians would believe in God because of this. And the Israelites now we see believe in God, but they also believe in who else? They believe in Moses. Who's been the guy telling them all along, God's going to get you out of here? God's going to save you. It's been Moses, right? And they've been grumbling about it the whole time. Remember at the very beginning when he went to Pharaoh and said, let my people go, right? God says, let my people go. And then Pharaoh made the work harder. He wouldn't provide the straw anymore. They went back to Moses, didn't they? What did you do? I can't believe you did this to us. You're ruining our life. Every step of the way, they have not wanted Moses. But now, on the other side, now they believe in the Lord and they believe in Moses. That idea that they didn't want to believe in Moses, by the way, will be brought up in Acts chapter 7 by Stephen. When Stephen speaks about Jesus to the Jews and how they wouldn't accept him, he says, he's just like Moses. When Moses came along, you didn't accept him. And yet he was your Savior. Jesus came along and you wouldn't accept him. And guess what? He's your Savior. So you've got the same problem. You've got the same heart as your parents did. So that's brings us through chapter 14. Does anybody have any comments or questions on that? Okay, so now they've come out the other side, and then chapter 15 is a psalm. Now, when we talk about the Psalms, most of the time what we mean is the book of Psalms, right? But technically, a psalm is just it's a song or a piece of poetry. And they exist in other parts of the Bible as well. Now, this is called the Song of Moses. In fact, we sing a song. We'll sing the Song of Moses and the Lamb. Is that the new song? Oh, yeah, that's why I couldn't remember it, because it's long. It's the long song. But we sing a Song of Moses and the Lamb. Here's the Song of Moses. And they sang the Song of Moses because what did God use Moses to do? Why do we call it the Song of Moses? Yeah, God used Moses, somebody said it, to save him. So when we talk about the Song of Moses and the Lamb, what would be the Song of the Lamb? Why would you have a Song of the Lamb? Who's the Lamb, first of all? Jesus, and we sing about him because what does he do? He saves us. So there's this connection here between Jesus and Moses that I want you to see. Now, before we go any farther, look over in Hebrews. Go turn to the New Testament, over to the book of Hebrews. And I want to stop and mention this because we want to make these connections between the New Testament and the Old Testament, but on the other hand, I don't want to leave any sort of confusion on what we're saying. In Hebrews, then you go down, where is it? Of course, now will be the time when I don't find it. Chapter 3, Hebrews chapter 3. Chapter 3, I don't want you to be confused. When we compare Jesus to Moses, we're not saying they're equal. Hebrews chapter 3 says in verse 2, "He was faithful to him who appointed him, as Moses also was in all his house. For he has been counted worthy of more glory than Moses, by just so much as the builder of the house has more honor than the house. Every house is built by someone, but the builder of all things is God. Now Moses was faithful in all his house as a servant, for a testimony of those things which were to be spoken later. But Christ was faithful as a son over his house, whose house we are if we hold fast our confidence and the boast of our hope firm until the end." Now Moses and Jesus are similar in the fact that they are both serving and protecting and functioning as saviors and functioning as leaders. But Moses is a servant in the house, but Jesus is a son over the house. And you think if you, let's imagine we're very, very rich people and we could all afford a butler. So you get a really fancy butler and he works for you for 20 years. How long does that butler have to work for you before he's equal to your children? The answer is he never is, right? He's never going to be. There's a difference, no matter how good the servant is, there's a difference between a servant and the son, right? Moses is arguably one of the greatest servants in the history of the world. Greatest servants of the Lord. But in comparison to Christ, he's nothing. So I don't want you confused. There's some parallels there. But Moses, though great as a servant, is nothing compared to the son. You go back to Exodus and chapter 15 there, and we have the song of Moses and Israel as they come out. And for the sake of this class, I'm not going to go through it. But it's a beautiful psalm, and I would recommend you read it on your own. Some of you will probably take that and read that while I'm teaching class and forget what I'm saying right now, and that'll be fine too. The point of that psalm is just looking at what God had done for them in causing them to leave Egypt and make it through the Red Sea. But then at the end of that psalm, down in verse 20, it says, "Miriam the prophetess, Aaron's sister, took the timbrel in her hand, and all the women went out after her with timbrels and with dancing. And Miriam answered them, 'Sing to the Lord, for he is highly exalted. The horse and his rider he has hurled into the sea.'" Now we're really reintroduced to Miriam. We've seen Miriam one time before. Anybody remember when we saw Miriam last? When was it? By the river. Yeah, down by the river. She was the one who was watching out for Moses as a baby. It's been a while, right? But now we're reintroduced to Miriam, and we find out that she is a fairly prominent figure in Israel. Miriam, when they're singing this song, Miriam is leading all the women out. Now, this will become a factor later on because at various times in the life of Moses, people are going to test his authority. Moses, do you really have the right to lead? And the people who will test him will be other people who have authority, but not as much as him. And at certain point, Miriam and Aaron will test Moses' authority. So, I mentioned we want to keep in our mind that there were other leaders in the nation. Moses just is, of course, the man with the greatest amount of authority. So then we go down to verse 22, and it says, "Moses led Israel from the Red Sea, and they went out in the wilderness of Shur, and they went 3 days in the wilderness, and they found no water. And when they came to Marah," that word Marah means bitter, "they could not drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore it was named Marah. So the people grumbled at Moses, saying, 'What shall we drink?' Now, this becomes the beginning of a grumbling process we're going to see on and on and on and on. The people grumble, what are we going to drink? Now, here's the pattern. Forget about the water. That doesn't matter. If it's not water, it'll be something else. All it is they'll be presented with something that they don't know the answer to. How are we going to get through this? And when presented with that, they're going to immediately turn to Moses, who is their leader, and say, mistakes have been made. But here's the problem. Moses is just a figurehead, isn't he? Who's really in charge? God is, right? Moses is just the figurehead. But God's the actual one. And they know it because we'll see later on, Moses had one thing that was particularly powerful as a sign of his authority and leadership is that he could go and speak to God, and he did something nobody else ever did and ever did afterwards, which is he spoke to God like a friend. That is, they would have conversations. And then when Moses would come out from speaking with God, anybody, for those of you who have taken classes on this before, What happened to Moses every time after he'd been speaking with God? His face would shine. That's right. His face would shine. So Israel would all see that. So they knew it's not just like Moses is some man that we all chose to be in charge. His authority comes from God. So when they say, mistakes have been made, Moses. Moses, why is this go wrong or why that go wrong? They're not really questioning Moses, are they? They're questioning God. And that is a major problem. And it's one that will ultimately lead to the demise of that entire generation. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 will explain with this generation that grumbled and use them as an example. And he says, we must not put Christ to the test as some of them did and were destroyed by serpents, nor grumble as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. What we're told is that every time they grumbled and complained, they were putting God to the test. And he says, don't you do with Christ what they did with Moses. Now, last time I checked, we don't grumble and complain about the same things that they did, because we're not in the exact same circumstances. In fact, I can't think of any circumstance in my life, at least as an adult. Maybe as a child, I complained about being too thirsty. But as an adult, I can't remember any circumstance where I've ever said, oh, there's no water. How did this happen? I mean, we live in a country where you've got water on tap, right? But I can think of some circumstances where I've been living my life the way God intended and things didn't turn out the way I thought. Where I've been doing what God said, and instead of receiving praise and blessings and good things, it seems like nothing but troubles heap at my doorstep. And in those times, I have found myself to be very inclined to grumble and complain that life's not the way it ought to be. And we got to be very careful as Christians, because it's not a small thing to complain. It seems like a small thing, right? In fact, we make a sport out of it, almost. We complain about the weather. We complain about sports. We complain about the holidays. And they're putting the decorations out too early in the stores now. I mean, we find things to complain about all over the place. To the point where now, I would say that the average person really thinks that the world's a very awful and dark place. And at times it can be, but I don't think it's as dark as we make it out to be. That's the other thing, right? I mean, there are bad things, don't get me wrong, but I'm not sure that it's as bad as what we would think it is. We become consumers of complaining. There's a reason when you watch the news, it's the disturbing stories that make it on the news. Why do they put the disturbing stories on the news? That's what the public wants, right? They're selling a product because they need advertisers. And the advertisers are only going to pay if there are viewers who are watching. So they're going to tell the news of what's going to bring in viewers. And it kind of tells you something about us as a society when the news that makes the news is the bad news, right? I remember there was a website, and here I'm digressing probably too much, but I remember there's a website that was only happy news. And I thought, boy, that's a great idea. And I kept going to it all the time until the website ran out of business. What does that say? Like, somebody made a website to aggregate and show all the happy news, and they didn't have enough viewership to make it worth it. That tells us something about us. Complaining is very easy. Being pessimistic is very easy. Be careful we don't put Christ to the test, that we're always saying, you know, if life were like this, then I would. No, that's what got 40 years in the wilderness and destroyed by the destroyer. So they're going to complain. And then verse 25, it says, he cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree, and he threw it into the waters, and the waters became sweet. Now, just to add to this, when they were looking around and saying, where are we going to get water? How many of the Israelites do you think thought, you know, if we just throw a tree in that lake over there, then we'll have great water? How many of them thought of that idea? None of them. That wouldn't have been on anybody's mind, would it? And yet, did that work? It just goes to show you God has plans that you don't even consider. It doesn't mean it won't work out. It just means it's not going to work out the way you thought it would. So then it says, there he made for them a statute and regulation, and there he tested them. And he said, if you will give earnest heed to the voice of the Lord your God and do what is right in his sight, and give ear to his commandments and keep all his statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you which I put on the Egyptians. For I, the Lord, am your healer. So God lays out there at Marah, after turning the bitter water sweet, he says, look, here's my test. Now, it's interesting because God does test us. But he doesn't test us the way that Satan does. When Satan tempts you, what does Satan want? What's his desire when he tempts you? He wants you to sin. He wants you to fail. That's right. He wants you to absolutely fall on your face, make the wrong choice. Now here, when you look at, and it says God tested them. Here's his test. If you'll follow me, this is what I'll do. I'll make sure that all the diseases that Egypt and all the places around, you won't have to face any of those things. Now, does that tell you something about what God wanted? Does God want him to fail or he want him to succeed? He's looking for success, right? That's his goal. That's his desire. So, yes, there are times where God says, I'm putting a choice in front of you. But his desire always is for us to make the right choice. He doesn't put choices in front of us with the desire for us to fail, but for us to succeed and for him to then be able to bless us. Now, along those same lines, now move into chapter 16, and we're going to now begin to look at the manna. Now, that's not manna. We don't have any pictures of manna, but it's snow. And in my mind, that's how I visualize it, is something like this. The description of manna, you'll get a couple of descriptions in the Bible. One is here in chapter 16, down to verse 14. It says, when the layer of dew evaporated, behold, on the surface of the wilderness, there was a fine, flake-like thing, fine as the frost on the ground. So that's one description, and I kind of look at that as like frost and dew, or a light layer of snow, that sort of thing. So we don't know what manna looks like. In fact, the name manna means, what is it? It's just kind of funny in and of itself. But God is going to feed them out here in the wilderness. So you're going to be out here where there's no food or anything, but he's going to take care of them. Now in verse 3 of chapter 16, it says, the sons of Israel said to them, would that we had died by the Lord's hand in the land of Egypt when we sat by the pots of meat, when we ate bread to the full, for you brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. So we're back to grumbling, right? And I might mention that statement they made, not only is it complaining, but is it accurate? Is it even accurate complaining? They did not. Let's go back to Egypt where we had pots of meat and bread in full. Was that what you were reading about earlier in Exodus? Because it seemed different than the account I was reading. It points out another scary habit that complaining does. Complaining puts us in the position of looking back at the past, and when we look back at the past, we paint it with rose-colored glasses. We take the present and we go, this is awful. I can't believe it's so bad. And all we see is the ugly stuff. And then when we think about the past, what do we say? Oh, it was wonderful. The good old days. That's right. Any older person ever, in the history of the world, we ever hear older people ever say, you know, when I was a kid, right? In fact, Ecclesiastes even warns about it. He says there's no wisdom in that. And it's a temptation for every single one of us. I find it coming out of my mouth with my kids. And it's this way that we have of, in the past, we only see the way things were good. We don't see the way the things were bad. I think of Lowell with this sometimes. Lowell loved to tell stories about his childhood, and he did, I think, really enjoy his childhood. But if you've ever seen pictures of where he grew up, Steve, they're out there in Casey, would that really opulent life out there that he had? Yeah, you wouldn't even call it a house, would you? You'd call it a shanty. But when you're grown up, the shanty's fine. You don't remember the cold nights and you know, everybody shoving into a corner and trying to figure out how to stay warm and all those sorts of things. So it's just funny how that is, and that's everybody's done that. It's just very natural. So here, oh, I wish we could die and go back to where there were pots of meat. So the Lord said to Moses, down in verse 4, behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may test them, whether or not they will walk in my instruction. Now here's the important point. The manna, and he'll go into depth with this instruction later on, but the manna comes down every day, except for one day. For you, those of you who are advanced scholars who've looked at this, there's one day where it doesn't come down. What day is it? Sabbath. It doesn't come down on the Sabbath. The day before the Sabbath, so on Friday, you would gather double portion so that you'd have enough for that day. But every day, they're supposed to gather enough for that day's amount. And if you tried to gather more, what's going to happen to it? It's going to rot. It's not going to last. And he says, I'm going to do this that I may test them whether or not they will walk in my instruction. That is, I'm going to give them a very simple instruction. God's going to provide everything. I'll give you food every single day. All I ask of you is one thing. When you go out to gather your food for the day, how much do you gather? One day's worth. That's it. One day's worth. And if you do that, you'll always have enough. But don't be tempted to say, you know, I just like a little bit extra. It goes to show you that even if you don't have to worry about money, can you be greedy? Greed's not really about the dollar bill, is it? It's about, I just want a little bit more. And so he says, I'm going to do this to test them. Now, what's interesting about this is, once again, God's going to test them, but what's God's desire when he tests you? He wants you to succeed. He wants your good. I want you to shoot forward in your mind to the New Testament and Jesus teaching his disciples to pray. Give us this day our daily bread. There is a very valuable thing that happens when we learn to trust God one day at a time. And when we try and accrue for ourselves stuff so that we don't have to do that, we miss out on some really valuable blessings. Now, Jesus said, give us this day our daily bread. But on top of it, he also talked about anxiety. And he said, each day has enough trouble of its own. right? You just take 24 hours. That's your job. You just worry about that. Don't worry about all the other stuff. And people who can learn to do that live happier, more joyous lives. Because if you spend your time worrying about where the man is going to come from 3 days from now, or how God's going to fix this problem, or how you're probably more likely how you're going to fix this problem a year from now, does that change anything? If I worry about stuff that's going to happen in a year, does that change anything? Just my disposition. That's all it changes. But if I do like God is testing them to do, you'll end up being blessed. So if they will be a nation that will trust him for their daily bread, they're going to learn some things that would be really wonderful. Down in verse 6, it says, Moses and Aaron said to all the sons of Israel, at evening you will know that the Lord has brought you out of the land of Egypt. In the morning you will see the glory of the Lord, for he hears your grumblings against the Lord. And what are we that you grumble against us? And so once again, that grumbling is addressed. Now, another thing I might mention with that manna that will come down is Jesus will talk about the manna in John 6. And Jesus will say to a large crowd of Jews who would have known their Old Testament history, he'll say, truly, truly, I say to you, it was not Moses who gave you the bread from heaven, but my Father gives you the true bread from heaven. For the bread of God is he who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world. And they said to him, sir, give us this bread always. And Jesus said to them, I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me shall not hunger, and whoever believes in me shall never thirst. Now, he's saying that this manna that we're seeing the Israelites get and gather up on the ground, it wasn't the real deal. It was just a shadow of something greater that was going to come. And what's the greater bread that's going to come? What did Jesus say is the true bread? Him. That's right, him. And so what were they supposed to do with the manna? Gather enough for every day. Now let me ask you, every day of your life, are you making sure to dwell upon the teachings and the words of Jesus and his apostles? Because that's the manna. You need it. And if you think, oh, but I came on Sunday, right? And we do that, right? We say, oh, well, I listened to Scott last week. That was enough. Look, you will never be fed enough if you wait for the preacher to shove it down your throat. It won't work. Because that's not the way it's meant to be ingested. It's meant to be regular. It's meant to be something that we do all the time. And so we've got to build that habit of it being the manna for our souls to take the words of Christ. And that's what in John 6, he'll say, you've got to eat me. And he'll clarify what he means by eat me is you've got to take my words. And you got to eat my flesh and drink my blood. And that what he meant is you got to take my word. Just take all of me, what I'm teaching, put it into you. And I'm the true bread. I'm the manna from heaven. With that, we'll move down to verse 8, where there's going to be another event that's associated with that grumbling. Anybody have any comments or questions? Yes. Sure.
So, but it's just their attitude. They could have gone to Moses and say, hey, Moses, we can't drink this water.
Yes.
And then Moses could have just said, hey, Lord, mm-hmm.
Then, absolutely. There's nothing wrong with making your request made known, right?
It's just their attitude.
Yeah. So one of the things I love about the word grumbling and murmuring, those are two words very associated with each other, is they are words that sound like what they are. Grumbling, that's grumbling. Murmuring, murmur. It's this talking and complaining in the background. See, that's what the encampment of the Israelites are doing. What are we going to do? There's no water. What did Moses do? We're going to die out here. We should have been back in Egypt. And so there's this talking amongst themselves that is grumbling. It's not like they said, you know, we don't have any water. Moses, could you approach God? Could you ask that he would take care of us? We know he did it. He parted the Red Sea. Will he save us this time? That's not what we have. Yeah. Yeah, because there's nothing wrong with making your request be made known to God. We're even told in the New Testament the same idea, right? If you have a problem, pray about it. Absolutely. Make your request be made known to God. Give him your burdens and then just move on with your life. It's like you said, it's the attitude of the grumbling and complaining. They're talking to everybody but God. So, yeah. Anybody have any other comments or questions? Okay, so then also here, after they grumbled, they're going to get another answer from God about their grumbling. It says, Moses said, this will happen when the Lord gives you meat to eat in the evening and bread to full in the morning. The Lord hears your grumblings, which you grumble against him. And what are we? Your grumblings are not against us, but against the Lord. And we address that, right? When they grumble against Moses, it's not just against Moses, but the one who'd given him authority. And then it says, Moses said to Aaron, say to all the congregation of the sons of Israel, come near before the Lord, for he has heard your grumblings. It came about as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation of the sons of Israel. They looked toward the wilderness, and behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, I've heard the grumblings of the sons of Israel. Speak to them, saying, at twilight you shall eat meat, in the morning you shall be filled with bread, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God. So it came about at evening that the quails came up and covered the camp, and in the morning there was a layer of dew around the camp, and when the layer of dew evaporated, behold, on the surface of the wilderness there was a fine flake-like thing, fine as the frost on the ground. And when the sons of Israel saw it, they said to one another, what is it? For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, it is the bread which the Lord has given you eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather of it every man as much as he should eat. You should take another, an omer apiece according to the number of persons each of you has in his tent. The sons of Israel did so, and some gathered much and some little. And when they measured it with an omer, he who had gathered much had no excess, and he who had gathered little had no lack. Every man gathered as much as he should eat. And so here, God provides the manna after their grumbling. And who had more? Everybody had exactly what they needed, right? And in fact, 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 15 will quote this, where it says, he who had gathered much had no excess, and he who had gathered little had no lack. In that, that's the attitude that we should have with the blessings God gives us towards our fellow brethren. If we know, like we heard about, and there when they had the hurricane down in Texas, and there were Christians in Texas, and they didn't have a home, and we were all sitting in our nice, comfy homes, and we had roofs over our heads. What's God's instruction for us to do when we know that there are Christians that we could be helping? Do it. He who has should share with him who doesn't, so that we're just like they were in the wilderness. That's what why Paul quotes that in 2 Corinthians 8, is that principle of he who had gathered much had no excess, and he who had gathered little had no lack, is that there are going to be times in your life where you have prosperity, in which case you should be looking for opportunities to share. And if we're doing it right, when we have times of lack in our life where there's a need, what are we going to find? God will have provided that through the rest of the brethren so that we take care of one another. So that we're like the children of Israel, where nobody starves. We should take care of one another. It's a principle that God has given to the New Testament church, to watch out for the needs of each other. And so it's a kind of a beautiful connection that Paul makes there in 2 Corinthians 8. Anybody have any comments or questions? Okay, then we'll stop there. And we'll pick up in verse 22 of chapter 16 next week.